Welcome to Curmudgeon's Corner for Tuesday, July 23rd, 2013. I'm Sam Minter. Yvonne Beau could not make it today. He said that he sent me a message late in the day yesterday saying that he was caught up late at work and was traveling tomorrow and couldn't make it. So I put out a call on Twitter for anybody to join. And our good friend Bruce Morton yes. volunteered. So hello, Bruce.
Hello. You are not alone today.
Not alone. So, yeah, so you were spared from one of those episodes where I just ramble incoherently for an hour.
Yeah, those are pretty bad, actually, I have to tell you.
Yeah, well, they vary highly, and I've done them in different ways at different times in the past, sometimes with more preparation, sometimes with less. It's a different kind of thing. In any case, so we do have a couple of things to talk about. So we've got NSA stuff. One, there were a couple new developments in the last week, but more to the point, you know, I've exchanged emails and such with Bruce and Twitter and things, and it's nice to have him on and talk about it directly.
Yes, that's something that is of interest to me. I've been following very closely the Snowden thing and all the revelations that he's been bringing out. And I hope that during the podcast I don't get into his listening mode, because I'm so used to just listening to you since I'm a listener. So if I'm not talking enough, please let me know.
Oh, no, don't worry. These things are so much easier when you're bouncing back and forth. And also there was this whole thread of filibuster reform that then sort of evaporated. We'll talk about that a little bit. And Bruce and I exchanged tweets yesterday about genealogy, which turns out we're both interested in a bit. So we may talk about that at the end. So let's start with the NSA stuff. I guess there haven't really been too many new things in the last week. There's still sort of Greenwald is saying that sort of the most explosive stuff he hasn't even put out yet. There was a congressional hearing, I guess, where one of the NSA folks let slip that sometimes they go sort of three levels deep from a suspect instead of two. And the reason this is significant is I'd made the comment, even with two, if you start out with, say, you know, a million people on the watch list, and you have all of their contacts, and then all of their contacts, you've already got
most of the country.
Everybody.
Yeah.
If you're doing three levels, well, forget about it. You don't even have to start out with the watch list of millions. You can start out with a very small group, and with three levels, you've basically got everybody who's not living under a rock. I mean, there have been, you know, the old traditional thing was the whole 6 degrees of separation. More recent studies have basically said that usually it takes less than five, something like 4.5 to 4.7 hops is the average to get between any two human beings on the planet.
Yeah, I heard about an experiment on that where someone sent a letter out to just random people all over the globe and asked them to hand deliver the letter to a particular person in New York City. And it was successful. The letters all came back.
Yeah. I mean, I did my own mini experiment with that a number of years ago. For a while I was doing this random trip thing, and I'd had one in Aylesbury, England. And I just said, you know, hey, I want to find a connection, somebody I know who knows somebody who happens to live there, and maybe we'll connect or something. And I didn't quite manage it, but I ended up getting very close, and it was after the fact. I'd already had the trip and come back. But I got an email from somebody who was basically like, hey, I live right near there, and my friend told me blah, blah, blah. And, you know, it was pretty remarkable. I didn't quite manage it, but I came close with not very much effort at all. And, you know, and I think, you know, for myself, I mean, it's very easy to get to anybody. I'm probably no more than three hops from Obama, maybe less. You know, it depends how you count. It depends. This all depends on, is it somebody you've met? Is it somebody you know well? Is it this? Is it that?
You know, LinkedIn also has a feature like that.
Yes, they do. They show you how many steps away you are from all of these connections. And, you know, it's real. it's remarkable how quickly it is, especially when you, because essentially the way you do it is you connect up to somebody who has lots of connections, and then you can get anywhere, you know. So I know somebody who worked in the Clinton White House, who worked directly with Bill Clinton, and then Bill Clinton, who knows how many thousands of people he's interacted with, and then you get to anybody else you want that way, you know?
Yeah, you know what? That's a very good point, because I actually know someone who worked in the Clinton White House, too. I just remembered. It's a friend from high school.
There you go. And I'm sure almost anybody can find something similar, even if you don't have, like, quite as close a connection than that. You only have to trade up a couple levels, you know, and then boom, you've got somebody big that knows tons and tons and tons and tons of people. You know, so anyway, the point is, with this 3 degrees of connection, you basically cover everybody. And so if that's the modus operandi, then, you know, whatever, you know,
so when they go to the FISA court,
saying about limiting it are really very narrow, and it's more to make it look limited to make it actually limited.
So when they go to the FISA court and they say, oh, these are people that are relevant, then they can just say, hey, these are people that are three hops away, and if they apparently they buy it because it's they've been able to get every single one of those except for like two of the thousands that asked for.
Yeah, and of course the whole it doesn't really count as looking at them unless a human being looks at it, but it's okay to just shovel in all the data for future reference. Also makes it so that you can always find something after the fact, you know, and it's all about the potential for abuse as well, that, you know, maybe it is all done perfectly well and wonderful, but, you know, if you've got that data, of course, eventually it's going to be abused. But anyway, I'm repeating things I've said a lot. You've heard our conversations back and forth, and I know you've been frustrated at least a little bit with our pessimism on this. So
actually, I was thinking about this today, and it's just a couple of random thoughts. Yvonne has been a little too critical of Ed Snowden, I believe. He was criticizing him choosing Russia. Well, he didn't choose to have asylum in Russia. Right. He was just ended up being stuck there because the U.S. wouldn't let him travel any further. And, I had already tweeted you about the fact that I think Hong Kong was a good choice because Hong Kong is actually a pretty free country. And as far as, you know, people say, oh, it's China. Well, it's a semi-autonomous region of China. And Hong Kong itself is actually pretty strong on civil liberties and actually pretty strong on their for protecting civil rights. So,
and my counterpoint to you though was, if any one of the areas that is specifically delineated towards China in that relationship is foreign policy, and this clearly has foreign policy ramifications. So it seems like if there was any conflict between, you know, Hong Kong and the mainland on this issue, the mainland wins, and I think that's true practically on any issue, to be frank. It's just that the mainland has decided that it's in its own interest to let Hong Kong have quite a bit of autonomy. But if there's ever a situation where, you know, the mainland feels like letting Hong Kong do its own thing would be damaging to China as a whole, I don't think they'd let that last very long.
Yeah. So, and clearly this is actually in China's benefit to protect them, because, you know, they don't want to be seen as being, following Washington's orders. So,
right.
Let me see. The other thing was that a couple of articles that I read this week, they refer to Ed Snowden as a kid, or they refer to him as some young man. And like, wow, he's 29 years old. And there's two aspects to that that I find just really frustrating is that in our society, it seems like the 20s, the decade of your 20s is now becoming like
what the teenage years used to be.
Yes, exactly. It's kind of like an extra 10 years of youth. And also when they for someone who's not doing the right thing, such as Bradley Manning or Ed Student, they consider him a kid who's just not in his right mind, not making the right choices. But if you look at a soldier who's 18, fresh out of high school, who's fighting for this country, oh, he's beyond reproach, and he could not be fooled by our country or generals who send him into these situations where he could get killed. So I
think you're right, though. I have seen that more and more, sort of the 20s are the new teens kind of thing, and you know, people apologizing for their youthful indiscretions that happened when they were almost 30, you know. And it's like, you know, I understand, like, I did some things in my 20s that now in my early 40s, I'm like, I can't believe I did that. I wish I hadn't. But at the same time, you know, I feel like you should be held fully accountable for your actions, certainly in your 20s, but I would argue that in most of your teens. I mean, even before sort of the legal age of 18, most people are more than capable of, you know, understanding what they're doing. And I understand the studies that, you know, brains aren't fully developed until the early 20s, blah, blah, blah. But they don't have to be. You know, at a fairly early age, the difference between right and wrong, unless there's something wrong with you. You know the difference between right and wrong. You have a significant amount of capability to determine what you're going to do. I think it's nonsense when, you do have these sort of, they don't know what they're doing because they were young kinds of things. But I think in the case of Snowden, it's probably a different thing, which is more diminishing his seriousness by calling him a kid. And I actually hadn't noticed that in the articles that I wrote, but I don't doubt at all that's out there.
Yeah. Oh, and one last thing is the one point Yvonne was saying that these countries that Ed Snowden is getting asylum from or applying for asylum from have very poor records, and Glenn Greenwald, poor records on civil liberties, and Glenn Greenwald had a very good retort to that very same point to a reporter, saying how individuals come to the United States for asylum all the time, and yet no reporters point out the irony that this country, who has a global torture regime, rendition, killing innocent civilians with drones, that find that as ironic that people would be fleeing to a country that does such atrocities.
Yeah, I think, you know, one thing I certainly agree with you there is that the United States over the last, you know, slightly over a decade at least, and arguably much longer, has given up most pretense of sort of higher ground that it has on these type of issues. It's just time after time, we've shown ourselves to be at best hypocrites on these issues. Very sadly. And I noticed over the last week as well, I believe the White House spokesman at some point made comments along the lines of Snowden is not a dissident. Snowden is not a whistleblower, et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, I'm like, of course he's a dissident. Whether you agree with him or not is irrelevant to that. He's clearly got political motivations on what he's been doing. Mm-hmm. And now he may also be a criminal. He probably is also a criminal. He broke some laws to do this, but most dissidents do. I mean, if you talk about, you know, the dissidents against the old Soviet Union, they were breaking all kinds of Soviet laws. So
they don't want to give an inch because, you know, the word dissident has a connotation.
Yes.
That brings us back to, you know, the Cold War. We protected dissidents, and say that they don't want that label attached to him, even though there's no argument whatsoever to say that he's not one.
Yeah, it's I find it similar to the it's the same kind of language nonsense that we're going, you know, whether or not what happened in Egypt was a coup. Of course it's a coup. The military took over. Now, whether or not you think that's a good thing is a completely separate question. But of course it's a coup. Let's use language for what it means. And similarly, there's been this horrible misappropriation of the word terrorist as well. So it now, you know, if you talk to academics, is a very strict definition of what that means in terms of violence against civilians for political means, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, we've heard over the last couple decades, over and over again, terrorist attacks, even if they're attacking the military, even if they're attacking government institutions, where meanwhile, cases that are clearly terroristic in nature, but don't happen to be, you know, organized Muslim terrorism, we would never use that word.
Or any kind of terrorist acts that are against Muslims. Like, yes, there was an attack in London a few weeks ago, and the newspaper reports never used the word terror in reference to it.
Well, and I was going to mention there was after the Boston bombing, there were a number of people who made statements along the lines of, this is the first terrorist attack on U.S. soil since 9/11, neglecting things like the attack of the on the Sheikh Temple in Michigan, you know, the snipers in D.C. were arguably terrorists as well.
Mm-hmm.
There were a few other incidents, and it's like, you know, but they go over people's radar if they, or under people's radar, I should say, mm-hmm, if they don't fit in this mold of terrorists, because essentially terrorist has become, you know, a shorthand for Muslims who don't like us,
yep,
as opposed to its real meaning, or even broader in some cases, which of course lets people distort all of the laws and everything else that were written that have anything to do with terrorism, because now it's anything anybody wants it to be, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Orwell is so prescient on this. He's more and more of a prophet every day.
Yes, in terms of rewriting language to make it mean what you want it to mean.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, if you're allowed to flexibly use definitions for things other than their, you know, historical common sense meaning, then you can make things mean whatever you want them to mean, and you can distort things completely out of shape, which I think is a lot of what's happened with the NSA. Is along those lines where laws were passed that granted extraordinary powers to the government to do things.
Mm-hmm.
But they were stretched even further by people using these, you know,
redefining the word collect.
Redefining the word collect. Collect doesn't mean store the information, gather the information and store it. It means look at it.
Yeah.
You know,
it's like, I'm not collecting your wallet. I'm not collecting your wallet. I'm just, if I grab it and run away with it, it's not, I'm not collecting it until I actually take the money out of it, right?
Right. I'm just borrowing it.
Yeah.
But I will say the one thing, despite the pessimism that I've continuously had about what this is going, I have seen some signs in the last few weeks of sort of Congress getting a little bit uppity on these things. In some of the hearings they've had, there have been a few members on both sides of the aisle who seem genuinely upset about what they consider overreach. Now, I'm not sure that it's enough at this point to do anything about any of it. And I believe there've been at least some news about some federal judge not granting the government the motions that wanted to dismiss cases that might be relevant to all this stuff. But there are a few glimmers that maybe things are moving in that direction, where you might see some of this stuff rolled back a little bit.
Yeah,
glimmers.
I read today that Justin Amash, Representative Justin Amash, was able to get a vote. Oh, he got permission from Speaker Boehner to have a vote on an amendment to the military appropriation bill to address some of these NSA things to reduce the funding for some of these programs.
Yeah, and I think, so you're seeing a little bit of motion, but I don't think I don't think you're going to get anything near what it would take to actually change anything. Because you at a bare minimum, you have to have a majority in the House, a 60-vote majority in the Senate, and then assuming a presidential veto, you have to be able to overcome that. So you need even higher percentages there, or you need courts that are willing to be activist on these issues. And everybody, and of course, everybody in the court right now on both sides, you know, was appointed by the last few presidents and has so far very much been deferential, let's say, to the executive positions on these things. And maybe that'll change. But, you know, so I see some glimmers of hope in that direction, but not enough to make me not pessimistic still.
Yeah.
You know, so we'll see. You know, I still think, you know, what you really need to see in order for this to change, public opinion has to flip first. And in order for the general public to care about this issue and care about it in the defense of liberty side of things, you have to have something exposed, which is a clear and blatant abuse that everybody agrees is abuse, not just something that the people who are civil liberties activists are like, hey, wait, they shouldn't do that, but are such that, you know, Joe Blow on the street, who hasn't really cared about this issue before, hears about it and says, you know, I can't believe they did that. What the hell? That has to change.
Yep.
So, anything else on NSA before we take a break?
No, I think that's good.
Okay, let's take a break. We'll be back. And we'll talk a little bit about the shenanigans around the filibuster.
Bye. Or hold on.
Yeah. Break time.
Did you make those break songs?
Yeah, yes, I did. all of those breaks are me or my daughter or a combination of the two or just, you know, me goofing around. And I keep meaning to make more, but it's another one of those things where I need like to sit down for a while to do it.
Yeah, most of them are okay; they're tolerable. But there's one of them I just really cannot stand. I can't think of it right now.
Yeah, well, if you identified it, I'd be sure to play it right now.
You're in the Valley, AM 1620, and LiganairRadio.com. This is where you'll find your favorite songs. Everybody's doing a brand new dance now. Come on,
baby. Let's do the twist. Well, they got a new dance and it goes like this.
I hit the radio dial and tune it up all the way.
I got a dance.
Dancing in the moonlight.
Classic music for a classic American town. AM 1620. And in stereo at LiganairRadio.com, the Valley.
Anyway, we're back. So the filibuster. So basically what happened this last week is that there have been the Republicans have generally been with everything other than first tier cabinet nominees have been filibustering and keeping them from coming to straight up and down votes when the president makes nominees for various positions. This has been strongest on appointees to cabinet offices where the Republicans generally believe the office shouldn't even exist at all. And I'm going to forget the name. The Labor Relations Board was one of them, maybe, something like that. But there are a couple of along those lines. There's also been a lot of reluctance to bring judicial nominees up for straight up and down votes. And there were seven of these in particular that the Democrats were really insisting, okay, these have waited long enough, they have to go. And were basically threatening that if the Republicans did not allow straight votes on these particular nominations, they would invoke what has been called over the last decade or two the nuclear option, which is basically that, hey, the Senate determines its own rules and can change them. And so there have been a number of arguments about how to do this. One is, at the beginning of each Senate, there's a short window before regular business occurs where you can vote on new rules.
And yeah, but we're not that time,
right?
No,
we're not at that time. So I'll get to that in a second. So that was the way that's been talked about most often as sort of the most far-reaching powers. You could throw out absolutely everything and start from scratch on the Senate rules if you wanted to do it that way. But as you point out, we're not at that period. What the other way to do it is that you could get a procedural rule, not a change to the rule, but a ruling on an interpretation of the rules that would be subject to a majority vote. And in some cases, there are some things that are only subject to a ruling of the chair, which is the president of the Senate, which, whenever he wants to be, is the vice president of the United States, or Joe Biden. In this case, what was being talked about is the interpretation of the rules. So basically, there could be a question brought to the Senate that says, given the rules, do we interpret them as requiring the 60-vote majority in this particular situation? And a simple majority would vote, no, it does not, and boom, you move forward. And both parties, at various times in the past, have agreed that this method is procedurally valid. It has never been used, or I believe it has been used, actually, in some lesser circumstances. But everything in the Senate, you've got to remember, is ruled by tradition more than it is about the actual rules. The actual rules allow almost anything.
Yeah.
And so it's all about tradition. And both sides have agreed that this particular mechanism is valid. The Republicans threatened to use it against the Democrats during the Clinton administration.
Yeah, they've been threatening to do this for years, but they never actually
They never
it.
Do, because what happens is the other side always blinks, because the opposition, whoever's in power and has the possibility to do this, at some point remembers that they won't always be in power. Mm-hmm. And they're going to want to be able to use these techniques next time they're in the minority. So you always have a back down. And it's one of those things where, you know, I think I'm not automatically resistant to the idea of supermajorities for certain things. Many of these things, I think, up and down votes are fine. Like, traditionally the way you would, way back in the days before the filibuster was being used as routinely as it was today, it would actually be considered two different questions. The first vote is, do you want to continue debate or not? And the second vote is, do you like the bill that you're passing or the nominee or whatever? Yeah. And so you would have lots of people who would actually vote to end a debate, but then vote against the bill knowing they would lose because they thought of those as two independent questions that, you know, yes, the proper thing to do is end debate. We've talked about this enough. Now let's have the vote. And if I lose, I lose. But then people realized, of course, that, you know, if you really didn't want the thing to happen, if you kept the vote from ever happening, then you got your way, even if you didn't have the majority. And so I think this is one of those things where it would be nice if both sides actually got together at some point and actually did some serious filibuster reform and put something in place that made sense.
It's never going to happen because it's something that the minority can use as their leverage to get anything done.
And what was brought up also, of course, is that it's not the only lever the Senate has as well. If you got rid of the filibuster today, the minority could still obstruct whatever it wants, because a lot of things in the Senate actually happen by unanimous consent. And there are all sorts of points in the process where even a single senator can object and keep things from moving forward. If there was one,
I thought that was the same thing as the filibuster, because a single senator can filibuster and they can put a. That's what a hold on the bill meant.
That is essentially when a single senator puts a hold on a bill, they are threatening to do that if the bill goes forward. But what could actually, a single senator could come in and every time someone says, you know, I'd like unanimous consent to blah, say no, and the Senate could literally do nothing. They couldn't even like adjourn for the day or open the meeting for the day, or put things into the record. They couldn't do anything if a single senator decided that they wanted to completely shut down the Senate. Now, there are interesting procedural things that could happen there to, you know, expel that senator if they really wanted to. But there's all kinds of things in the Senate. There are all kinds of roadblocks. Like I said, it's all about tradition. I agree it's probably never going to happen. I kind of wish it could. I wish you could just say right up front, this class of things requires 66 votes. This class of things requires 60. This class of things requires 50. There be the rules. Let's go.
Yeah. Well, it's kind of like a way for the minority to, you know, I'm sure that they don't really care about these particular appointments, these particular nominations. They're just trying to use it as leverage to be able to get their bills on. It's like, for example, in the House, the minority can't do anything.
Right.
If they have a bill, if, you know, any Democrat, if they want to have a bill on the passed, they can't even get a vote. So.
Right. Yeah, I mean, every once in a while when I dream of writing constitutions, I think of what everything you could do with sort of modern technology about these things. You know, you could have a system where any member can introduce a bill. It automatically starts a vote that lasts 7 days, you know, or there's some period of review time and then a 7-day vote, you know, and then kill amendments, introduce a new bill if you want it. There are all kinds of interesting things you could do to sort of further democratize sort of the kinds of things Congress does. And because basically right now, the majority leaders and parties, because they have the control of what even comes to a vote, have enormous power over what happens. Individual members of Congress can't do anything unless they've got a broader base of support there. And I would find it very interesting to see what would happen if all sorts of things actually just came up for actual votes. Because there are all kinds of interesting coalitions that you could see potentially happening that would be cross-party along single-issue lines that you'll never see happen in the current structure. And, you know, maybe that's okay. I mean, there's certain things to be said for gridlock, but it would be interesting to see what things that there actually is majority support for could get through if you actually allowed majority votes on many more issues.
Yeah. And well, this is slightly a separate issue, but I wanted, what you mentioned reminded me, I'd like to see the number of representatives go back to the original apportionment before.
That would be very interesting. For those who don't know, the original apportionment said something like one representative for what it was, at every 100,000?
Actually, I'm 50? Looking up on Wikipedia, 33,000.
33,000. And now it's millions, it's, potentially,
it's,
right?
No, it's 700,000.
700,000. Okay, close to millions. but yeah. And at some point, the House of Representatives decided to cap the number. And that was within their powers to do. And so it stopped growing, and obviously you'd have a really, really large House of Representatives if indeed.
I think I read somewhere it'd be something like 20,000 representatives.
But the whole idea was that these would be people elected out of small enough communities that everybody would know their representative practically personally.
Yes.
And you'd have that much greater connection. It also makes things like gerrymandering much more difficult to do on a large scale.
And it also makes buying Congress a lot more difficult too.
Yeah, it potentially. Yeah, I think that would be very interesting. I also, one of my things that I've occasionally talked about is that I wouldn't mind seeing the way the Senate was picked go back to how it was originally picked as well, which is chosen by the state legislatures, because I realized there were a lot of reasons why that was undone in the early part of the 20th century. Basically, the whole process was corrupt. People were buying senators, and that might well happen again. But basically, the notion was originally that the House was the representative of the people, but the Senate was the representatives of the states. And I thought that was I generally like the federalism concept, and that was a strong part of it. And once you eliminated that, it made it much easier for, I mean, essentially now senators are, because they're also popularly elected, serve the same sort of dynamics that the House does, and undermines the idea of having the different branches of government all having different sources of power and therefore different interests, and therefore sets up the tension between the branches and between the houses of Congress. And I think that's eroded a lot. And, you know, if I could wave a magic wand, I'd put some of that back. But then again, you know, you've heard me say, I would also make the Electoral College a deliberative body again, where you actually elect your electors and without them having pre-stated preferences for president. And then they go in and decide
decide or just pick them at random.
Well, I like that even better. Yes, I do like that one even better. There is a lot to be said by randomly choosing representatives. But anyway, filibuster, it all went poof. It didn't happen. It probably will never happen, like you said. But, you know, the Republicans have started blocking the next set of nominees again. So we'll see, you know, do we have another one of these showdowns in a few weeks, or do we wait a few years before the next one?
Yeah, it's just going to be, it's always going to see, it's going to be the situation where it will be who blinks first, and it'll never change.
Yeah, the minority will always blink first in that, because they don't want, no situation that actually removes power from the minority is going to be allowed to happen, because even the majority doesn't really want it to happen.
No.
But the more this comes up, though, the more there's the chance that someday one of the sides will miscalculate and it'll happen by accident.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, who knows what happens next? You could always undo it, but it's one of those things where probably once the genie is out of the bottle, it'll be really hard to put it back. Okay, let's take another break. And then Bruce and I will talk a little bit about looking up your ancestors and things like that, which, you know, both of us have done a bit on. I don't know how many of you out there have spent any time doing that, but it's kind of fun, actually. So we'll be back after this. So, anyway, I'll tell you where I got into this. I always was sort of curious and interested, but never had time. And then in 2005, I forget exactly where it is, when I moved from Florida to Washington State, I preceded my family by about 9 months. And so I was living in an apartment all by myself. My furniture was an air mattress, a desk, and a chair. That's all I bothered to get. All of the rest of my furniture was still in Florida with my family.
What part of Florida?
In Palm Bay. Palm Bay, Melbourne, okay. Palm Bay area.
I've worked at Harris one summer.
Okay. Yeah, we're Brevard County.
It's a nice area.
Yeah, it was okay. I was there just under 2 years. But in any case, this time period, this 9 month period where I didn't have my family and I came home from work to an empty room with a computer and a desk, I was like, I got some time. So I started digging in and pulling together information, and I started putting things in a spreadsheet. And then at some point I decided, hey, you know, it'd be really cool to put this in a wiki because, and my logic was, A, I was familiar with editing them both from Wikipedia and from stuff I did at work, and B, I thought it would be a cool idea to put it out there in such a format that if other people found it on Google, they could just edit it themselves. They, you know, they wouldn't have to like tell me, here's a whole bunch of information, and you know, I would have to do it. If they found an error, fix it. And
as
so,
if there's a sizable portion of people out there willing to edit wikis.
Well, you know, there's. I'll tell you, it doesn't happen every day, but I have had random distant cousins come and edit my Wikipedia wiki, not Wikipedia wiki, my genealogy wiki pages about once a year.
Really?
About once a year, somebody will come in and make some minor changes or additions to those pages. And that's not counting spammers. That's real people making real edits. And about three or four times a year, someone will stumble across them and send me stuff that they're not comfortable editing or doing whatever themselves, but they'll say, hey, I came across your pages, you know, here's some other stuff you might find interesting. The most recent one of those was just last week, where somebody sent me some stuff tying to some ancestor of mine, and some interesting stories about them, as well as genealogical, you know, here's whose father was father or whatever.
I'm amazed because you don't really have that many names on your list. I scanned through your list there and I didn't see anything that I'm related to, but
no. And I have a spreadsheet linked from there that has a bunch more names that I haven't put on the main wiki yet. But most of the people actually find, you know, those particular names. And if I had the rest of the list that I have that I just haven't bothered to put in wiki form yet, I'm sure I'd get, you know, even more of those kinds of things, because what happens is, you know, people Google their ancestor's name and, you know, my wiki page is one of the first few results, and they click through and they see stuff, and, you know, there's a quick link to email me right there, and there's a link to edit right there. And so every once in a while they do it. I mean, it's not, like I said, it's not every day, it's not all the time, but the interesting thing to me is, of course, first of all, it's just the detective work of finding all these links and connections. But also you find interesting stories. I mean, I guess not everybody has, everybody's interesting, but you know, with the whole 2 × 2 × 2 × 2 × 2,
yeah,
you're almost guaranteed to find a bunch of interesting people in your
just history. Like what we were talking about earlier, you know, the 3 degrees of separation and or whatever, 4 or 5, you're going to find somebody. Being familiar with the names in your family tree really helps a lot. In my article that I wrote, or in the talk that I gave at church yesterday, I mentioned that I was watching this miniseries about the Hatfields and McCoys.
Right.
And one of the characters, in the first episode I watched, I noticed that one of the characters' names was Jim Vance, of the Hatfield clan. And I was like, I have a Nancy Vance who lived in West Virginia about that time.
Right.
So I looked it up and found a link. And so I realized, I'm part of the Hatfield clan. So I watched the rest of the miniseries in a whole different light. And so,
well, and here you go. We're getting closer. One of my grandmother's ancestors, and I forget exactly which one it was, the family lore says they once dated, I believe, once one of the McCoys. It could have been one of the Hatfields, I forget. But it was one of them, and they didn't actually marry. There wasn't that connection. But they dated them once. And and one of the ancestors around that part of the family tree was more directly involved in another. The Hatfields and McCoys were apparently one such feud out of a whole bunch in that part of the country and that part of history that you know, some people have even classified as like sort of mini wars, because there were all kinds of back and forth between all kinds of families, and my family was involved in one of those. And I haven't done a lot of digging in that particular area yet, other than you know, I ordered a couple books that talk about that part of things that apparently mention some people. But you know, the interesting thing about all this again is like, you know, you don't often think about in your daily life, well, what is this family history? Where did, you know, you may know your parents' stories and you may know a little bit about your grandparents' stories. But chances are most people don't know very much at all beyond that. Mm-hmm. And they're just, there's a huge supply of interesting things to find out about what there's one branch of my family where there was a huge tragedy where, like, on the littlest girl's birthday, they were celebrating the birthday and her dress got in the fireplace, caught on fire, and several of the children died, and the one survivor ended up being one of my ancestors.
Wow.
You know, and it's like, wow, you know, that must have been horrible, but wow, you know, that happened. You know, all kind of, and again, the process of finding it too is interesting too.
And it's getting so much easier. Yeah. And one of the things that I wrote about is that, well, full disclosure, I'm Mormon.
Yep.
And the LDS Church has been looking, I won't go into the reasons why, but the LDS Church has been gathering microfilm or taking microfilm of records from all over the world for about 80, 90 years.
And has become an amazing resource for this kind of stuff.
Yes. And so the microfilm, back in the 60s, they needed a place to store all this microfilm that was piling up, and they wanted a secure place in the middle of the Cold War. So they built a vault in Granite Mountain near Salt Lake City. And these tunnels that are bored into the granite are a perfect environment for storing microfilm, and it's supposed to last about 300 years. But, of course, we've had digital technology, and so now they're taking digital photographs mm-hmm. of all these records, and they're transferring the microfilm over digital form, and but still there is no digital storage technology that is better than microfilm,
right.
And so so meanwhile they have to transfer the data over, I think they're creating their own cloud storage or their own database storage inside the mountain too. And in the process, and then having the images, they're putting those images online on the FamilySearch.org site. And then in addition to that, they're going through a process called indexing, where people are volunteering to look at those images and type in the names so
right.
that
so th- this is
searchable.
This is like scans of the original documents of who was on board a ship that landed somewhere coming across the ocean, or birth records, or whatever, right? All mm-hmm. of these kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah. And so all this, and so there's literally, you know, billions of these images that need to be read and transcribed. And it's going to take years and years, even though there's hundreds of thousands of volunteers working on this. So if you go to the FamilySearch.org site, if you have spare time, and it's usually the older people who are doing this.
Yeah.
Who are transcribing these records. And yesterday I was talking to somebody about this, and the real difficulty is that this needs to be done now because the younger generation in the schools, your daughter you may know this because of your daughter's mm-hmm. age, they don't teach cursive in school anymore. They may cover it like in 1 or 2 weeks, but kids don't know how to read cursive anymore.
It's definitely a dying art, and you can understand why. In day-to-day life, it's less and less relevant. But certainly, if you're going back and looking at historical stuff, you know, I mean, not even stuff that not even hundreds of years back. I mean, if you're going back and looking at stuff from the 50s and 60s, you got to know how to read handwriting,
yep.
You know. But all of this. It is very cool work to have happen, but the amazing outcome of all of this is it used to be, if you wanted to do genealogical investigations, this meant going around to courthouses and churches and looking at old record books and traveling around the country looking at gravestones.
Or at the least, just ordering films, having to wait weeks for it to arrive, then having to stick it in the microfilm reader and then searching page by page to find one name.
Right. And when I started this, I mean, it's remarkable how easy this is. I mean, even without, I mean, there are a number of specialized searches, like you mentioned Family Search, and there are a bunch of others, Roots Web, Ancestry.com. There are tons of these, right? But without even going to those specialized ones, the way I started was simply, okay, what do I know off the top of my head? You know, I can name my four grandparents, and I picked up the phone, and I talked to my parents and my one grandparent who was still living at the time, and had them send me some information going back one generation further. And all I did was Google those names, and I started finding connections further back in some of that other people had put up, because you know, tons and tons of people, like I mentioned, I put up my wikis, tons and tons of people put up their information through any of these other sites or their own websites or whatever. And all you have to do is find a distant cousin who's already gotten to a certain point in your family tree, and boom, you get all of their research too. If they've chosen to make it public. And so I only had to go back to my grandparents and great grandparents before I was able to find tons of stuff online just with simple Google searches. And then once you start using some of these other sites, you have some more powerful ways to search, where you can search based on birth date and place of birth and all kinds of other stuff. I started finding floods of material way faster than I was able to process it and put it into any form that I could use. I ended up, like I've mentioned, I have a nice big pile of stuff. Some of it is stuff that I've gotten from relatives, because when they found out I was interested in this stuff, they are all like, oh, okay, you can have the stuff I have, because I'm not doing anything with it. So I got a whole bunch of either originals or copies from various cousins and great uncles and stuff like that, and for both my family and my wife's family. And then I've got, you know, stuff I've found online, and I've just like, I've got a bunch of this stuff. I want to put it into my own database, but that takes time. And you and I were talking real quick, like, the best way to actually do it is to, you know, hey, you have 5-10 minutes, do a little bit at a time. I always find my problem is I get so excited by this stuff. When I start it, I want to go for several hours. So it's really frustrating for me to like go in and like, just I'll add one fact and okay, I'm done.
Yeah, that's what I try to do. I say, okay, I'm going to pick one name, and I'm going to work on that one name for just a few minutes. And I subscribe to Ancestry.
Yep.
And Ancestry's really cool. One thing that I like, the thing that I like most about it is that you put your database up there, and while you're offline, it's in the background doing searches on your stuff.
Excellent.
And it's like constantly doing searches. And they're constantly adding databases. So they have these, the way they indicate whether something is what may be a match is they'll put a little leaf next to someone's name. Right. And so I'll just check on Ancestry, once or twice a month, and boom, there's a whole bunch of new leaves. And I just click on them, look at the sources, and say, oh, yep, that's a source that points to that person. And so I'm just constantly adding new sources, making corrections, additional information, new links, all the time.
Yeah, I had sort of, when I was doing, and I spent that 9 months I was by myself, very intently doing this kind of stuff, and then it really petered off, and I was doing just a little bit every month, and then once my son was born, I haven't touched it since, essentially, so that's like the last 4 years. But I'd sort of decided that, you know, I want to exhaust the free resources before I go to the paid ones. And I was still finding so much stuff for free that I, you know, and like I said, you know, with the amount of time I had, I wasn't able to suck in and do everything I wanted to, even with the information I had. So I hadn't yet moved to the paid source. But they're, like you said, they're clear. Once you're into this, you know, Ancestry is the big one, of course, but there are a few others out there as well. That provide a number of good services at relatively small costs. And if you're actually really spending time on this and this becomes a little bit of a hobby, it's certainly worth a few bucks.
Yeah. And this conversation is actually timely. I just noticed today that the new season 4 of Who Do You Think You Are premieres tomorrow night on TLC.
And that's, I've heard of it, but not watched it. That's basically where they take somebody and do some genealogical research for them.
Yes,
right?
they go to different movies or TV stars and movie stars, and they do their ancestry for them, their genealogy for them, and they actually go to the places, go to where, you know, they learn the history about their family, and it's really interesting. And the thing that really kind of pops out when watching this is that, you know, these actors and actresses, they're just normal people, just like anybody. And so you really realize that if you were to do your own, there's no reason that you couldn't find some really interesting, amazing stories of your own family. So
yeah, and like I said, I've found tons without going that far. I mean, and I'm lucky. I have a family that there's a lot of documentation for. You know, it's many generations back before we even leave this continent on any of my paths. And so there's lots of documentation and there's lots
that
of
that saves
stuff.
Money too. But once you go onto Ancestry, you can get the United States records.
Yep.
And that's a lot cheaper than getting the world thing. And I haven't done the world thing yet because all my ancestors, I'm kind of like you. All my ancestors on all my lines came to America in the 1600s.
Yeah, I think I haven't for sure found the earliest one, but almost every line I've found so far that I've gone back far enough has been along those lines. You know, the first couple of waves after the Mayflower, as they say. You know.
Yep.
But you know, tons and tons. I mean, I've got generals on both sides of the Civil War. You know, there was a small town in New England somewhere that like a couple of branches of my family apparently intertwined for a number of generations. You know, there's all kinds of fun stories. There's one guy I've got, I've been in the process. Well, when I sort of petered out and ran out of time to do these stuff, one of the things I was doing was transcribing onto my wiki the full diary of one of these guys. Harvey Hiram Holbert III, I believe was his name.
Wow.
And I've got like a 200-page, it wasn't a contemporaneous diary. It's basically a memoir he wrote when he was getting up there in years, covering his whole life. And, you know, he started out on the East Coast. He went to the West Coast. He went back and forth. He met a lot of famous people. He did a bunch of things.
Wow.
You know, and...
that's real history there.
Yeah, and I've only, you know, I've only read like the first, you know, 20, 30 pages of it because I wasn't just sitting down and reading the whole thing. I was typing it as I went. And it's, you know, written in his own handwriting. It's a photocopy of a photocopy of a photocopy, but it's incredible stuff. It's fun to look at because you get the sense of like this person as a real person, not just a name.
Yeah,
And it's also, the flip side of that is, of course, you also will find people where the absolutely only thing you know about them is their name, and that they had a kid that happened to be your ancestor or whatever. And it gets so frustrating because, like, I want to know more about that person. I want to know what they did. I want to know what their parents were. I want to know other kids they may have had. And the information's not out there, or at least not in a place you can find. And that's frustrating too, but it's...
Well, unfortunately, you know, the vast majority of people throughout history lived very simple lives where...
of things weren't recorded.
The only thing that was ever recorded was their birth, marriage, and death. And that's, you know, other than that, they just spent their lives in quiet struggle. And
I've found, I've done a little bit on my wife's family tree as well. And on her father's side, you know, I can't go further than, I don't even know her father's father. I have her father's mother. But not beyond that. And her father's father is sort of a family mystery. You know, she doesn't know it. He might or may not have been a legitimate child. And there are a couple different stories about maybe who it might have been, but there's nothing, You know, and we don't have a copy of the birth certificate, and my wife doesn't really talk to the other parts of the family very much, and so, I'm waiting for the Social Security death record to come out to see if I can find more there, but it's very different depending on what that history is, and who the people were and what their circumstances are. And you're right, it's a lot easier to track the histories of sort of educated rich folks who kept track of all this stuff.
Yeah.
Versus poorer folks who weren't very educated, who didn't have as much information, and it didn't bother to note all this stuff.
I was reading the will of one of my ancestors today, and you can see how he writes down, you know, I leave my cow to my son, I leave my estate to my wife until she remarries, it's interesting stuff.
Yeah, the furthest back family lore, which I think I've gotten close to disproving, is my mother's maiden name is Brandon, and theoretically, family lore has them related to the hangman the executioner, I should say. It was an axe, not hanging, who executed the king before Oliver Cromwell took over England. But there's a gap that we can't prove that connection. And I think there's countervailing evidence that is probably not actually a direct ancestor, but because basically all the evidence about that hangman, none of it mentions him having any children.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, it's interesting family lore. And there's another piece of family lore where on another completely different side of my family, there's supposedly American Indian, and you get to that particular person in the history, and you find out that there are so many contradictory stories about this guy and what happened to him and what his paternity, who his parents were and what he was doing, because it basically appears that this guy was a con man who traveled around, Tennessee, Kentucky, that kind of area. And everywhere he went, he made up new stories about who he was. So you can't really tell what the truth was. So anyway, like I said, interesting stories. And for anybody who doesn't care about this stuff, I apologize for boring you. But if you haven't looked into this stuff, it really is addictive. You know, just start with the folks you know, your parents, your grandparents. Ask your grandparents and grandparents for another generation back if they're still around to tell you. And write down what you already know and then start just Google the names. You'll start finding stuff, and it's addictive. It's just the act of searching itself is so fascinating. It's detective work.
And there's just so many free tools and resources that,
I sort of got distracted from that point. But, yeah, in the olden days, there was a lot of legwork involved in doing this kind of research. Now you can do tons and tons of stuff just sitting at your desk on your computer and find out amazing things. Yeah. Anyway, thank you for joining us, Bruce.
It's my pleasure.
We'll probably have Yvonne back again next week. I do appreciate you. It was fun. And, mm-hmm. As usual, email me at abelsmay@abelsmay.com or you can find me at Twitter at abelsmay. You can find Yvonne at imbo. And, Bruce, you're a BYU fan, right?
Exactly.
And, thanks for listening, everybody. Tune in next week. Goodbye.
Bye.